We know how it began.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
But 9 years into the war in Afghanistan, who knows how it will end? Ask a vet.
Hey, how are you? This is Steve Husong out in California. Here's what I'm saying. How long have we been on the South North Korean border? How long have we been in Bosnia? How long have we been in places that we have decided to take in the past? It never ends. It will never end.
One vet's view, but Operation Enduring Freedom endures. It has been fought against no superpower, no regional alliance. Our enemy in Afghanistan doesn't even constitute a nation.
9 years into Afghanistan, talking with the Taliban, and other milestones in America's longest war, and President Obama's biggest challenge.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry back once again. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning and welcome back.
Thank you very much. A very special program here on The Takeaway on Thursday, October 7th, the ninth anniversary of the beginning of conflict in Afghanistan between U.S. forces.
Almost a decade.
Exactly right. Joining us now is Gideon Rose, author of How Wars End and the new editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine. Good morning, Gideon. You'll be with us all hour. Thanks so much for that.
Thanks.
Are we seeing glimpses of the end with reports on these Taliban talks and, of course, the military situation?
You know, it's always possible, but I really would doubt it, frankly.
And that's because there's no certainty as to what the scenario even is coming into focus, or are we in a stalemate?
Well, it's both. We don't know exactly what's happening with these talks. And also, although Afghan factions often switch sides and end wars that way, they usually do so to side with the winner. And the reports that are coming out about why this is taking place don't ring true with that story. It's not like the tide is turned significantly against the Taliban and they're peeling off to bandwagon with the winner. And so I would be a little skeptical that they've actually given up. I don't think they think they're beaten.
Well, we're going to talk more about those talks in just a moment. Your book, How Wars End, will it need a new chapter if this war ever does come to an end in Afghanistan?
Well, I touch on Afghanistan in the conclusion, but certainly the second edition and later editions will have a longer discussion.
We don't know how that war will end. Gideon Rose, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. All hour, Afghanistan on The Takeaway.
In the meantime, though, let's get a check on other top news stories this morning. NATO says 8 insurgents have been killed, including a senior Taliban official after an airstrike and raid in northwest Pakistan. The leader, identified as Malawi Jawadullah, was accused of organizing deadly ambushes, roadside bomb attacks, and abductions. He was killed along with 7 other members of the Taliban. NATO says Jawadullah was linked to the recent death of 10 Afghan national police officers.
The U.S., meanwhile, is apologizing to Pakistan nearly a week after an American missile strike killed at least 2 Pakistani soldiers and wounded 3 others. The U.S. ambassador to Pakistan is acknowledging 2 Afghanistan-based helicopters entered Pakistan, quote, several times and mistakenly fired at a military post. After the strike, Pakistan shut down a key border crossing used by NATO. It's the first civilian trial of a Guantanamo Bay detainee, but it's been delayed. A key witness was barred from testifying yesterday because investigators learned of his existence through coercive questioning. Prosecutors are deciding whether to appeal the judge's decision.
And the FBI has announced the indictments of nearly 100 Puerto Rican police officers and dozens of others on drug trafficking charges. Attorney General Eric Holder says the investigation is the largest police corruption case in FBI history.
New report finds $162 million in stimulus money is unaccounted for on the government's economic recovery website, and that toxic waste spill in Hungary has finally reached the Danube River this morning. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down. Futures flat. The Dow gets underway at 10,967. The S&P starts at 1,159, and the Nasdaq opens at 2380. Later on in the hour, we'll discuss what an exit strategy from Afghanistan may require from our military and our government.
But in the meantime, we're wondering, what do you think? 9 years into the war in Afghanistan, are we seeing glimpses of the end, or is it never ending? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Good morning, everyone. A special program here on The Takeaway. All hour long, we're going to take a look at various aspects of the war in Afghanistan, which is
9 years old.
9 years old today. I remember where I was. It began on a weekend. It's a very clear, beautiful day in Massachusetts when they started reporting that the conflict had begun, that the bombs were falling, and that this would be the first response, really, principal response to 9/11.
To the 11th attacks. Indeed. Yeah, shock and awe.
Yeah. And 9 years later, shock perhaps that it's 9 years long.
Yeah.
Awe to think that we don't really have an end game at this point.
It could, yeah. No, awe isn't what I'm feeling, but it's possible.
Indeed. Well, here to talk about it all hour long, we've already introduced him to you, as Gideon Rhodes, author of How Wars End and the new editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks. Our war is a fourth grader.
Indeed.
It's true.
Indeed. But we begin this morning with Fatina Christia, who's assistant professor of political science at MIT. She joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, Fatina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We want to begin with the news this morning that the Washington Post is reporting, and some other diplomatic sources are disclosing, that the Afghan government is in talks with the Taliban about essentially ending the war. First of all, what do you make of these reports? And a negotiated solution to a 9-year-old war, is that even practical? Fatini?
I think the only way to a solution would be through negotiations with the Taliban. I mean, this is a sons of the soil type of insurgency. There's no way we can kill our way out of it. As far as the talks are concerned, I mean, there has been discussions about such negotiations for a while now. I don't think that these are any more credible than what we've been hearing so far. I mean, I would argue that they're just contacts and nothing systematic or high level enough just yet.
Let's take it apart a little bit. On this program, you have separated sort of talk with high level Haqqani, sort of tribal leaders within the Taliban and others, as being very distinct from the sort of come in from the cold negotiations that the Afghan government has offered to lower level members of the Taliban. Do you think these talks that are being disclosed by the Washington Post and others are simply an extension of these lower level contacts?
I mean, clearly people have been trying to differentiate between reconciliation and reintegration. Reintegration being kind of lower level combatants, reconciliation with higher level leaders. Practically, it's never going to be the Haqqanis. These are kind of considered the irreconcilables. It's more Quetta Shura type Taliban, and what they're trying to hint is that they're talking to high level members from the Quetta Shura. But as I said, what we hear is very conflicting. Some people say that it's high level, some people say it's not high level enough, very preliminary. I think the whole idea is that they feel they need to show progress given the upcoming December assessment of the Afghan war, and they are hard-pressed to do so at a time when the government is getting a lot of negative attention about graft and corruption.
Just to be clear, the they you're referring to is the Afghan government, right?
Absolutely, yeah. They're the ones who want to take a lead in this, especially at a time when Pakistan is also trying to take a stake in these negotiations.
So, Fatina Christia of MIT, what exactly does the Afghan government get out of publicizing the idea that they're in talks with the Taliban? And is that message meant for the Americans, or are they speaking to the Taliban?
I mean, there are definitely different audiences here. The big one, I would argue, is us. They want to show us that they mean business, that they're serious, that they're trying to make progress. I mean, we are the lifeline of this government. The longer we stay, the longer they stay in power. The Talibs, of course, are going to deny that there's any sort of negotiations going on. If this is high level enough, both sides have an incentive to keep it a secret. I think the reason why this story broke out yesterday is basically because today it was the inauguration of the first meeting of the government's new High Peace Council, which is basically a group of roughly 70 Afghans from all political factions that are supposed to work towards reconciliation.
Inside analysis there from Fatina Christia of the Political Science Department up at MIT. Fatini, hold on for a second. Gideon Rhodes, let's get an analysis of that right there. Can the Afghan government deliver a peace agreement, and why would the Talibs talk with the Afghan government when the big play is really to deal with the Americans directly?
Well, there could be ultimately some kind of reconciliation, as Fatini said, but the question is whether this is it, and I don't think this is. And the significance of what Fatini is saying is, I mean, she's written some excellent stuff for Foreign Affairs on this topic, including an article last year called Flipping the Taliban. So if there's somebody who would recognize a reconciliation in progress, it would be Fatini. So I'm very curious and interested to hear her say that she's not convinced that this is anything deeply serious.
Well, Fatini, what's the difference between flipping the Taliban and a negotiated settlement with Taliban leaders then?
No, I mean, the way we were describing the flip had different components, obviously, both a reintegration and a reconciliation one. And these negotiations, as I said, if they were to happen, they would be the key to peace. I mean, the whole idea is that we need some sort of power-sharing arrangement with the Taliban, but how do we make it credible and self-reinforcing? This is going to be the issue. And I don't think the government has signaled any credibility so far.
So glimpses of the end, 9 years in Afghanistan. Are we seeing a scenario that looks a little bit like the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and a power-sharing arrangement? Or are we seeing the fall of Saigon, 1975, vis-a-vis the North Vietnamese-South Vietnamese conflict? What do you think Afghanistan looks like 5 years down the line?
It's going to be hard to tell. I mean, it really depends on how we end up leaving the place. As I said, I've heard talks about us needing to strike a power-sharing arrangement, but there are other people saying that all we need to do is build up the Afghan National Security Forces, contain the insurgency, hand it over to the government, and leave. So it really depends on how we exit, and then we'll see how long they're going to last or whether there's going to be another civil war.
That's quite a list.
I was going to say, that's all we need to do, Fatini?
Yeah, that's it. Just that little list, and we're done, right, Fatini?
Yeah. Just the final
right.
status talks, right?
Well, describing there the challenges in Afghanistan 9 years in, Fatini Christia, she's been on this program many times talking about the future and the present in Afghanistan. She's assistant professor of political science at MIT. Fatini, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A final thought, Gideon Rose. It's a complicated list, unlikely to get done in 9 years,
well,
9 months.
And the basic question is the political question of who is going to win or have the parties agreed to have a draw, and we don't see any real evidence of that yet.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine, is our guest all hour as we talk about Afghanistan 9 years into the war. We're going to have some headlines, take a break, come back. We'll talk to Gideon about what victory actually looks like in Afghanistan and also take a look at what the role of women has been throughout this conflict. Thanks so much, Gideon.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Gideon Rose is with us, author of How Wars End. He's the editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine, part of a special takeaway this morning looking at Afghanistan 9 years into a war that we've already declared victory. And remember, the Taliban was rolled up shortly after we entered that conflict in 2001, October 7th of 2001. Gideon Rose, what does victory look like this time? Since we've already rolled up the Taliban, they came back. What would it look like this time?
Victory is a sustainable political settlement that doesn't require a massive ongoing American violent military presence to keep moving forward.
Something the Soviets have tried already, something the U.S. has already tried.
It's either defeating one side or letting the parties or getting the parties to come to a place where they are actually able to live with each other. And neither one of those prospects seems in the offing right now, unfortunately.
All hours, 9 years into Afghanistan, implications for all sorts of communities inside that country and, of course, in the United States. Gideon Rose is author of How Wars End and editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine.
And as we talk about the possible maybe end of the Afghan war and whether or not that will include power sharing with the Taliban, that's probably not a great message to the women in Afghanistan who lived under Taliban rule before, women and girls who were systemically excluded from social, political, and economic affairs and their freedom to move freely about was severely restricted. Here to talk to us about the conditions for women in Afghanistan during the Taliban's rule and now after post-Taliban, supposedly, is Anne Jones. Anne is a photographer, journalist, and the author of Kabul in Winter. And most recently, War is Not Over When It's Over, Women Speak Out from the Ruins of War. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
We spoke earlier this hour, just a few minutes ago, with Afghanistan analyst Fatini Christia about the supposed secret negotiations between the Taliban and the Karzai administration. And I'm wondering what your reaction is when you hear people mention the possibility of power-sharing agreements with the Taliban. What would that mean for women in Afghanistan?
Well, it can't mean anything that's very good, but, you know, the negotiations are not really secret anymore. They haven't been secret for a while. And Karzai's newly appointed Peace Policy Committee has begun to meet today, as I understand it. And that's a body that consists of 76 people, only about six of whom are women. And worse than that, most of the men who belong to that peace policy group are the usual suspects, the same old warlords, the same people who many Afghans would like to see tried as war criminals, and no representatives whatsoever from civil society or from the political opposition. So it's not just women who are going to suffer from these negotiations. It's all the progressive forces and civil society groups in Afghanistan.
Well, you've written you think that the Afghan women have been abandoned, and certainly when the United States went into Afghanistan, the freedoms of women was one of the things that they touted that could be achieved through intervention from the Americans. And now you say they've been abandoned?
Well, I believe they have. They were full of hope, and they've fought valiantly over the years to try to secure the rights that they have been given on paper in the Constitution and in various treaties. But for the last 5 years, one after another of the women leaders has been assassinated. Laws have been rolled back. You know, the Karzai government that we put in power years ago is essentially a government of fundamentalists, not very different at heart in their attitude towards women and towards progressives than the Taliban themselves. We're supposedly fighting for democracy, but we don't have democratic forces in power.
Well, I mean, what about policies like the one you were embedded with the U.S. Army in Kunar province earlier, and that was where the U.S. military was trying to train members of the female engagement team to build relationships with local Afghan women. Is that the kind of policy that could work?
I don't think military policy, whether it involves women or not, can work, and I think that's the general agreement of most people, even in the military, that there is no military solution to the conundrum we've involved ourselves in there. Certainly these little half-hearted efforts with female engagement teams in the military are not working. You don't make peace with soldiers.
Ann Jones is the author of Kabul in Winter and most recently War is Not Over When It's Over, Women Speak Out from the Ruins of War. Gideon, any response to this idea that a power-sharing agreement could be nothing but bad for the women of Afghanistan?
I agree entirely, and I think it's a kind of sobering thought that people don't know. You know, Americans always focus on ending the war and getting out and coming home, and it's sobering to realize that as nefarious as one thinks the United States may be, we're far better than the local alternatives that would follow if we actually did pull out. And the hope for Afghan women and Afghan men, frankly, would be that we actually managed to stay long enough to achieve something real. Because if we pull out, at best, we will extricate ourselves but leave behind all the good guys to the mercy of much less liberal forces.
And power sharing means, when you're talking about religiously based parties, power sharing means that any sort of political concession involves the suppression of women and the enforcement of religious law. And we've seen it around the world.
You got it.
Gideon Rose is the author of How Wars End, the new editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. He's writing along with us this hour in our special coverage of 9 years into the Afghan war. And we want to hear stories from you.
As First Lieutenant Casserly, I deployed to Afghanistan in the spring of 2007 to 2008. And as I look back and my experience, I've got a couple mixed emotions, I'm sure a lot of soldiers who return to the States do. I'm proud of all the soldiers that served with me on the outpost.
We want to hear your stories, especially if you've served in Afghanistan. Of course, 9 years in, do you think we're seeing glimpses of the end in Afghanistan? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. All this hour, we are marking 9 years, the nine-year anniversary since the beginning of the war in Afghanistan. Maybe glimpses of the end, maybe not. But we want to get an update on where we are in this war, and riding along with us all hour long is Gideon Rose, author of How Wars End and the new editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Good morning, Gideon.
Good morning.
Right now, we want to focus on that border between Afghanistan and Pakistan that we've been hearing so much about lately. Troops are actually in the midst of Operation Dragon Strike there. That's an offensive operation to drive the Taliban out of their stronghold in Kandahar. That's the historic birthplace of the Taliban. And could it shift the balance of power, this Operation Drag Strike, or is it simply becoming central flashpoint in the war, which is why we're having border crossings and drone attacks and attacks on convoys? Where does the Pakistan fit into this picture? We're going to get an update first from Rod Norland, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning.
Can you give us details about Operation Dragon Strike and its importance either symbolically or strategically?
Well, I think it has much more modest goals than your first question suggested. It's concentrated on trying to pacify the districts around Kandahar City, specifically several districts where the Taliban have been traditionally very strong and where large parts of those areas are kind of no-go for coalition forces and for the Afghan government.
Well, but they're fighting very heavily near the hometown of Mullah Muhammad Omar, obviously the leader of the Taliban. But how important is this? Is it a symbolic victory for them to drive the Taliban out of Omar's hometown?
I guess it would be. And in Zari district, where his hometown is located, there's actually been a lot of fighting there for quite a long time, going back to when Canadians were in that area, all to the same lack of any clear result. And although there are a lot more American troops committed to it this time, I'm not sure they're going to get any further. So far, indications are that they simply go out on patrols, you know, to draw fire, and they respond by attacking Taliban. And the Taliban seem to have a fairly steady supply of willing cannon fodder and keep going at it in that particular area. What they really need to do and want to do is change the overall balance in the south, and particularly in Kandahar. And the Operation Dragon Strike is a long way from doing that.
Well, this offensive was rather publicly a joint civil and military effort here, which was supposed to change its both success rate and the tactics. So how many Afghan troops are involved in the offensive in ratio to U.S. soldiers?
Well, for the first time, there are actually more Afghan troops and police, if you count the police as well, involved in an operation than there are Americans. At least that's what they say, and I have no reason to doubt that's true. But, they continue to say, the Afghan forces are taking the lead, they're fully partnering with us, and so on. And there's a lot less evidence that that's true. They always say that, and when we tot up the body count at the end, the casualty counts, we see that the Afghan army particularly has a very low body count, which suggests that they're perfectly happy to let the Americans do the dying and stay out of the real fighting themselves.
That's an update from the Afghanistan side of the border from Rod Nordland. He's a foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Rod.
Sure.
From the other side of the border, we want to speak to Marvin Weinbaum. He's scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute and former State Department analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan. Good morning, Marvin.
Good morning.
Well, this is not the first time these drone attacks that have caused the United States to have to apologize to the Pakistani government. It's not the first time that NATO troops have attacked paramilitary forces in Pakistan. It's not the first, certainly not the first time they've used drone attacks there or caused casualties. What's different about this particular attack?
Well, this was different. This immediate reason for the closure had to do with a helicopter attack at a border post in which three Pakistani paramilitaries were killed. So it is a little different. There has been a tacit understanding for some time now about the drone attacks, that as long as they were pretty particularly well targeted, few civilian casualties, the Pakistan government would look the other way. On this occasion, the death of the Pakistanis became public, and this, in a sense, challenged the government there, also a weak government, to show some backbone and play this card that it has, and that is the ability to stop our transport of American equipment going into Afghanistan.
You know, Marvin Weinbaum, we've been noting some of the ironies in this nine-year-long conflict. It's America's longest war. With the benefit of historical context, to help us out here, the overwhelming concern about crossing the border into Pakistan and the sort of incremental nature of these drone attacks certainly is at odds with the Vietnam experience, where Nixon opened a secret war inside Laos and Cambodia without any sort of concern about public opinion. There's a whole different sort of context of this war. On this program last week, Bob Woodward said that the U.S. military's overriding concern in opposing Obama's need to find an exit strategy early is the Vietnam experience. That puzzles me, Marvin, because it seems like we're back in the Vietnam experience precisely, and that the military is driving this without a clear outcome, with an open-ended commitment. What do you think?
Well, I think the military does have a plan, and that was the strategic plan that Petraeus originally devised and McChrystal was to carry out. And it was essentially to be able to change perceptions in Afghanistan, to score some important victories, particularly in areas like Kandahar, which we recognize as the really tough-going areas, to score some victories and to turn the tide, to change the initiative here, and that in a period of time, in that case it was 18 months that they were looking at, they could show enough progress to be able to take out some troops. And if they did not show progress by that time, to perhaps look for a plan B.
Marvin Weinbaum, let me ask you, we're asking people all morning long if they're seeing glimpses of the end to the war in Afghanistan. Is there any scenario to the end of the war in Afghanistan that doesn't involve solving this troubled relationship with Pakistan?
Well, I think everyone agrees that Pakistan is key here, that you can succeed, but ultimately, if they can find sanctuary in Pakistan, that you'll never really fully be able to wind this up. I just want to mention, though, that both of these countries' fate are intricately linked together. If things go badly in Pakistan, things will deteriorate further in Afghanistan and vice versa.
Marvin Weinbaum, a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan. Thanks so much.
Continuing now with our discussion of 9 years of war in Afghanistan and what does it mean on many different levels, we want to welcome to the program Waheed Momand, who is the board president of the Afghan Coalition, the largest Afghan-American nonprofit organization helping the expatriate community in Northern California and around the United States. Waheed, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, one of the consequences of the war in Vietnam was that Arlington, Virginia became known as Little Saigon, and there were communities of expatriates from Vietnam all over the United States, Hmongs in places like Minnesota and California. The Fremont, California community is the largest expatriate Afghan community in the United States, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, Waheed?
Yes, sure. You're right.
What has that meant for the communities where Afghans have settled, and what is daily life like for expatriates trying to keep track of what's going on in their own country in the 9 years of war here?
Yeah, you know, the people are very much involved with Afghanistan, with the news from Afghanistan. Currently, you know, because there are several satellite TVs, that 24-hour TVs, that they are broadcasting news from Afghanistan, so people are able to instantly know what's going on in Afghanistan, and so they are watching and very much involved in that and trying to do whatever they can from their side to help Afghanistan.
Do Afghan civilians see an end to this conflict? Do they have a scenario in place where they say it will all be different? Do they tell their children what that scenario might be?
Yeah, I know everybody wants to see an end to this war, but unfortunately, you know, the way it's going, nobody can predict what's going to happen tomorrow, because it's going now for a long time. And it was not necessary to be that long, because, you know, for a long time under the pressure of the war in Iraq, there were not enough resources devoted to this war, and actually it was a forgotten war. But lately, in the past 2 years, after President Obama took, you know, came into power, basically, so the strategy has been changed, and there are now enough resources devoted to Afghanistan and they are trying to change the, you know, the events there in Afghanistan. But we are doing whatever is possible, but still there are elements that we don't have control over that, and that's, those are unknown elements that basically, you know, nobody knows.
Sure. Well, I can hear your frustration, Waheed Mohmand, who's board president of the Afghan Coalition, which is a nonprofit organization which helps the Afghan community in Northern California, particularly around Fremont, California. In the United States, in the news, we keep track here in the United States of the number of American casualties in this war. Any idea of the number of civilians in Afghanistan who have died in the last 9 years?
See, there are each year about several thousand, probably 4,000 to 5,000 to 6,000 civilians are dying in this war, because that's the war casualty. And we are trying to minimize the number of civilian casualties, but it's impossible to
sure
make it zero.
Well, 5,000 to 6,000 per year for 9 years, that's 56,000 people, and that's not a count that we keep here in the United States. Waheed Mohmand, thanks so much for being a part of our discussion. Waheed Mohmand is board president of the Afghan Coalition in Fremont, California.
The first time ever I saw your face.
We believe that peace is at hand.
The top song on the radio back in 1972 was Roberta Flack's hit that constitutes just one of the cruel ironies of the end of the Vietnam War. The first time ever I saw your face. There's Henry Kissinger as Richard Nixon's national security advisor announcing the peace talks that had begun in secret with our bitter enemy, the North Vietnamese. The Paris peace talks were the first time most anyone in America had seen the face of the enemy who wasn't actually a soldier fighting the war. The talks were not easy. The Nixon administration was trying to achieve what it called peace with honor.
It is inevitable in a war of such complexity that there should be occasional difficulties in reaching a final solution.
The complexity of the war in Vietnam was that the U.S. could find no military solution on the ground. The South Vietnamese were increasingly incapable of taking over the fighting and winning on their own. And the American people had had it with the casualties, the uncertainty, and the pain of a conflict producing so much turmoil at home, even though it was in a place halfway around the world, that many Americans had difficulty finding on a map. The demonized North Vietnamese were the only ones to talk to. The whole Paris peace talks had a feeling of inevitability to them.
The whole evolution of the Indochina tragedy and of the Vietnamese war has been a realization, a slow realization by all the parties, that they could not impose a military solution on each other.
That realization may have been slow, but the cost of coming to it was staggering. Tens of thousands of Americans dead, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese killed, and many more to die before the end, nearly a year later.
The following statement is being issued at this moment in Washington and Hanoi. At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam was initialed by Dr. Henry Kissinger on behalf of the United States and Special Advisor Lee Duc Tho on behalf of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
The treaty at the end of the Paris peace talks with North Vietnam ended the American involvement in January of 1973. The top song in that year?
What
Tony Orlando's song was a direct commentary on the end of the Vietnam War, but not the end of the story. South Vietnam fell in 1975. The region was destabilized for a decade, and in America, we've been tying those ribbons ever since. And as we hear reports now that talks may be underway with the demonized Taliban in Afghanistan, 9 years since the beginning of that war, we're going to conclude this hour with our guest, Gideon Rose, author of How Wars End and editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Gideon, I saw you shaking your head as I made some parallels with the Vietnam earlier in the hour. What do you make of the parallel between possible talks with the Taliban and the peace talks in Paris that were such a relief to Americans back during the Vietnam era?
You know, the Vietnam analogy has dogged every American military intervention over the last several decades. Usually it's not appropriate, but the more you look at Afghanistan and the more you look at Vietnam, the more it actually does seem that there are a lot of parallels. We're in a thankless insurgency, counterinsurgency struggle in a strategically remote and not especially critical area against a determined enemy with a local ally who is not particularly effective or attractive. And the prospects are not good for success, but the prospects for the locals, if we pull out, are even worse. So there actually are a lot of parallels. And what we achieved in 73, what Nixon and Kissinger got, was not an end to the war, really, but an extrication of the United States, because everybody really knew the local parties would sort of keep on fighting. And sure enough, when the Americans turned their backs on what happened, the North turned around and conquered the South, leading to a tragedy in South Vietnam that was in many respects even worse than the war itself. So there's no good answer. And what's happening in Afghanistan is sort of eerily reminiscent, frankly, of a lot of things. And the question Americans have to answer for themselves is, how important do we consider it that there be some kind of non-Taliban government in Afghanistan? Because the local correlation of forces without our involvement seems to favor our enemies. And so the only thing that, basically we can end this war easily if we walk away and let the enemy win.
And in the end, in Vietnam, the fact that there was a communist government in Vietnam ultimately was not terribly significant, and we didn't complain terribly much with the Khmer Rouge government in Cambodia.
Well, it was terribly significant for the Vietnamese, sure, who got royally screwed, the boat people. And, put it this way, it was not geostrategically significant for the United States. We couldn't survive, and the world order survived, but it was not a particularly good thing for our local proxies.
But what about the argument that Afghanistan would again become a haven for terrorists?
Well, you know, there's a definite risk of that. And essentially what the Obama administration is grappling with is, should I stay or should I go? If I stay, there will be trouble. And if I go, there will be double. And that's the basic dilemma. And the question is, do you want the costs of staying or the risks of leaving? That's the real question.
Let's think about costs to the people in Afghanistan. You know, we've tried to create a sense of historical scale here in thinking about U.S. policy and U.S. strategy. But yet, if we look at Afghanistan solely from the civilian perspective, the casualties that have been seen in this war compared to the casualties during the Civil War in the 90s, compared to the Soviet invasion in the 1980s. Put that into some perspective for us.
It's funny. Americans discussing their wars tend to be both solipsistic and not particularly comparative. We focus pretty much only on our side rather than the locals. But we also tend to beat ourselves up a little more than necessary. So the local consequences of the wars are almost invariably more dramatic. There are more locals and civilians suffering than there are our troops, even though we don't necessarily care that much about them. By the same token, the American involvement is often much more benign than we give ourselves credit for. So that as bad as the war has been in the last decade, frankly, it's a dramatic improvement in Afghanistan from the previous decade, which was civil war among competing warlord factions, and then the decade before that, which was an almost near genocidal Soviet
involvement. Scorched earth policy in Soviet.
In which, almost half the population was dramatically affected by the war in some way.
So, well, then before we go, is this a trend? You're an editor at Foreign Affairs magazine. Is this a trend positive for the Afghan government looking back to the 1980s, or is it another episode of death with the numbers just a little bit lower?
You know, I think there is a glimmer of hope that if the United States would stay over a very long term, it could perhaps produce something positive in Afghanistan that would be sustainable. The problem is it will come at great cost. There's no certainty about that. And the question is whether the stakes really are justified in making the effort.
And terrorists can find another safe haven, if not Afghanistan. Gideon Rose, thanks so much for being with us this hour. Gideon Rose is the author of How Wars End and editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. He was in the studio with us all hour, 9 years into Afghanistan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As John mentioned, we've been discussing the war in Afghanistan all hour long, and we want to know what you think. 9 years in, it's the beginning of the 10th year in Afghanistan. Are we seeing glimpses of the end?
My name is Russell Galletti from Cleveland, Ohio. I was a lieutenant on a mentor team with the Afghan Army from Baghlan Province. Every soldier enters our country with the optimism that if anything will ever prevent September 11th from happening again, it will be success in Afghanistan. After a while, that optimism is ground down, and we come to find that deficiencies in the Afghan Army, constrictive rules of engagement, or the bureaucracy of our own army and ISAF themselves are far greater challenges than the insurgency on its own merit. I want very badly for the coalition to succeed over there and think that we ultimately will, but that we have a lot to overcome of our own creation before substantial progress is made anytime soon.
Thoughts from Russell Galletti, a friend of the show. He, along with his wife, Mary, joined the program back in January just ahead of his deployment to Afghanistan.
We talked all hour. He said that in 34 seconds.
I know. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org. And again, a big thanks to Gideon Rose, author of How Wars End and the new editor of Foreign Affairs, who joined us all hour long. Thanks.
Thank you.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.